We made this.
Welcome to the Starlight Ballroom. Hey!
Hello and welcome to Shipwrecked and Comatose, the podcast about Red Dwarf here on the We Made This podcast network. And we are on day two of our seven-day bonanza of episodes covering the Red Dwarf's magazine. So welcome back, Colin.
Hello.
And welcome back, Carl.
Nanu, nanu.
Oh, for fuck's sake. Get out of it.
Hello there, everyone. How are you doing?
So funnily enough, we're looking at issue two today. This was also the Red Dwarf magazine. It's dated April 92, which means that Colin pointed out that it was probably released in March 92.
Yep. End of March, yes.
Why is it? It's really fucking confusing.
Magazines have always done that, and I don't know why.
Wrestling magazines used to be a pain for it because all the events that they would be covering have already happened.
Is that because they were imports and took a bit longer to get over?
Possibly. I remember reading about a Royal Rumble that in like April that happened in January.
Wow. So, should we just get on with it? We've done our kind of chat. I think this is going to be a shorter episode, he says. Front cover. It has awesome artwork of the boys at Justice World.
Yes.
So there's Escort Boots, it's by Colin Howard, and I did moan last time about there not being like an inside thing, and this one does mention that there is a Secret Life of Crichton article later on.
Yes.
I think with this, as soon as you open it up, and even on the contents page, someone somewhere has gone, we need to make it more visually impactful, and they've done that on this. Whereas before, in the first issue, we had lots and lots of text. Now we've got, it's almost like the Red Dwarf set itself. We've not just got walls, we've got walls with holes in with light shining through. Now we've got text, but it's in boxes.
And yeah, it's got a contents page, which, you know, is nice. We didn't have that in the first issue.
I mean, it's still a team of, I think there's like a couple of extra people from like photographers, but it's still the original team of six from the first issue.
Yeah.
I think crediting the photographers does not count as part of the team.
Yeah, because I don't think many of the photos, if any, were taken specifically for the magazine, were they? Yeah, I think true. They're just publicity photos from the series that they've stuck in there.
So the first article is the comic strip, which continues the adaptation of The End. And in my notes, I've put, isn't Frankenstein the cat really pretty? She's lovely.
Yeah, it's interesting to see how some of the characters are drawn. Obviously, you've got Rimmer and Lister who look pretty spot on. And then you've got other characters in this, like Kachansky, who looks completely different from what you get in the show. One thing I did notice is when we get to the frame where we first meet Kachansky, there's someone in the foreground with a beautiful tash.
Yes.
Just a fabulous mustache.
I wonder why they changed Kachansky to a blonde.
Wasn't it? Because Claire Grogan wasn't the original person, was it, that they wanted?
She wasn't originally, no.
But this would have been years later.
Kachansky in the comic looks a lot more 80s than Kachansky, than Claire Grogan, who was in the 80s, looked.
True. And I think one thing I did notice as well was that they had added to the script with some thought bubbles of what the characters were thinking, which obviously is kind of a very much a comic-y thing compared to a telly show. So credit where credit's due. We did moan that it was basically the script, whereas they did play with it a little bit going here.
Yeah. It's also got when Rimmer looks at the astronavigation exam, he just says "eep," which I have said for most of my life, and I might have picked it up from there.
Love it.
The thing I've always thought is in the books, in the novels, when Rimmer does the handprint in there, rather than it just being a full handprint, it's just his palm of his hand and a middle finger just pointing back at himself. And they didn't do that in the telly or in this comic. And it, I almost think it's a shame, but maybe they thought that was a bit too much for what they're doing. Also, any time they draw Rimmer's salute in these comics, it looks a bit weird.
Yeah, you can't quite get the ludicrousness of it. I think in the last issue it was, when he was doing it, it looked like he was slapping Todd Hunter.
Yeah. I like things like as well, it's a very, when Lister's talking to Kachansky, there's the hearts all around him. It's very Deirdre's photo case book.
Fuck me, Carl, your references.
I remember Deirdre's photo case book purely more from Viz when they used to do it.
Yeah. But really, I don't feel like there's much more we've got to say about the comic strip. It's a continuation of a story we've already told.
Yeah.
I do like the way that, because obviously they're having to make it so they can spread it over a few issues. It is done quite well in terms of when they choose to end the comic strip. So in this one, you've got the big drawing of Holly saying 3 million years, and it's a proper like dun 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 moment. Yeah. I think that's quite good, because in the show it's not really, is it? It's just a very casual gag almost.
Hmm, that's fair.
But in this, it works quite well as a cliffhanger.
Next up is our first ad, which is for Batman and Superman. Later on in the mag, there is an advert for 2000 AD, the complete Judge Dredd, and Red Dwarf 3 on VHS.
Oh yeah. And is it Red Dwarf 3 that's got the 18 rated VHS?
No, that was 4 because of Clitoris.
Is that?
Yeah, 4? Yeah, in Polymorph.
Oh, right, okay, yeah, it is 4.
Next up is Lister's Cookery Ideas, and it's his recipe for peach surprise, and I howled like a hungry prairie dog because I am a child.
This is the bit that I was talking about yesterday, where this is one of the bits that has just always stuck in my head ever since. It's amazing. Lister's Cookery Ideas, Peach Surprise.
Don't spoil it. I want people to read this mag and see what Peach Surprise is, but...
That's fair.
Oh, I howled. I absolutely howled.
And it's such a simple premise that works, isn't it? It's with the drawings and everything. Part of me does wonder, at conventions, have they ever sold leopard lager as like a gimmick?
I think they should.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So next up is a Crichton and Camille pinup. And later on in the issue, there is a pinup of Lister and the lovely cat. But I'm a bit biased because... Bender.
which one are you though, Mike? Yeah, Airbender or
nice reference. Next up we've got Robert Llewellyn interview, which again, a huge name. You know, they start with Chris Barry and they're straight into Robert Llewellyn. They mean business with the interviews. Definitely. And one of the things that I took from it, fascinatingly, is because the suit is so it's like a fucking sauna clamped to him. He loses weight when he plays Crichton.
Yeah, because he's sweating the whole time.
And isn't it famously like his very first scene in the suit, he was in a sauna anyway?
Yes.
Yes.
He's lucky he survived that one.
He's got to love his job.
I think he does. Yeah. I think that really comes across in the interview, or he at least did.
Yeah.
But he does, in the interview, talk quite a lot about he likes the scenes where he occasionally gets to not have all of the latex on.
I remember, I think it's in one of the documentaries he's talking about, when he's there, he thinks it's going to be a helmet.
Yeah.
It's like, it's going to be his jaw, but it's going to be like, it's just going to be a helmet like RoboCop. And then it was like, oh, right. It's going all over, is it?
And yes.
I probably would have turned around. I'd have probably, because that kind of thing freaks me out. I have had that a face mold done before, and I hated it. It was literally about 20 minutes with the things up the nose, and I hated it. So it was like, yeah, you've got to do this for about 4 hours. Like, no, sorry. Going to have to get somebody else.
Yeah, I don't think I'd want to do it.
I really like the bit in the interview where they asked the same question that they asked Chris Barry in the previous one, where they said, when you started, did you anticipate it become as popular as it has done? And he's talking about how he had one guy that actually recognised him on Oxford Street once and shouted, "Hey, you're Crichton," because he'd obviously seen the episode where he is out of the suit. But I think it's quite cool that he did get recognised at that point, because obviously most people wouldn't necessarily have seen him outside of the costume.
Yeah, that is cool. I hadn't thought about that, but you're absolutely right.
It must be odd. I mean, it must be kind of comforting. I remember seeing a thing with Ron Perlman.
Yeah.
And he was talking about Hellboy, but he said he had it when he did Beauty and the Beast as well.
Yeah.
And that he was under so much makeup. And then some fans came to the set one day thinking, "Oh, we're going to meet Hellboy." And he came out in, like, no makeup. And he said he's never seen anyone look so disappointed.
Love it. Next article is holograms, which is a letters page that has been gimmicked. So there's letters from Rimmer, Kevin Keegan, Lister, the cat, and it wasn't very funny.
No, but it is. You can tell that it is. I think they were expecting to have some letters and hadn't had enough or any that were worth printing yet. That was the impression I got from it, and I think it's a last minute shit, we've got to fill a page. Let's pretend that Holly's making them up.
Yeah, I think you're right.
The fact that there is the address for people to write in, I think they are. I like the one that Hilly sent one from a parallel universe, and it's basically a love binary letter. Yeah, like, that's quite sweet.
the one that there is one that I did quite like. That's "Dear Holly, can you tell me what a black hole is?" from pseudonym. I like the fact that it was just. Holly's obviously put in there. She knows what a black hole is. That's one of her bits of knowledge. So,
true.
And then a letter from Kevin Keegan, obviously.
They do like their Kevin Keegan gags in the Red Dwarfs magazine.
Well, it's one of the books that Holly's read.
True. Next up is the Red Dwarf USA report. And it covers some of the initial ideas and... I didn't know that David Lynch wanted to direct Red Dwarf.
That's what I saw, yeah. That was the first thing that stuck out to me. I don't think it would have worked, to be honest.
I prefer it to what we got.
Well, yeah. Even in this article, though, there is this undercurrent of, it's not going to work.
Yeah.
They question Craig Bierko's casting already before it's anyone's seen it, and that's fascinating.
Yeah.
A thing I notice as well is when they're talking about the cast in the first sort of bit of it, when they talk about Hinton Battle, and they sort of go, he's an experienced singer and dancer who's had a successful theatrical career. That's Danny John-Jules.
Yes.
That's basically his opposite number. And it dawned on me, it's like, that's actually quite smart that they've gone and picked, right, what did that guy do? Get someone like that. But it just happened that they got someone who was a bit older than Danny John-Jules to do it. But in looking at it there in sort of black and white, you just go, actually, yeah, that's a pretty smart idea. And made me think, like, if it did go on for a few more episodes, whether they'd have given a chance for him to show that off a bit more, like they did do with Danny John-Jules.
Yeah.
And then speed up the dancing so it's incomprehensible.
Exactly. You are obsessed.
There was one quote that I noticed that I thought was quite interesting in there, where it refers to Fox Television as the newest and smallest of the big four television networks.
Yikes.
Yeah.
But this would have been Simpsons time, wouldn't it? This would have been...
So wait. Does that mean that Red Dwarf USA is owned by Disney?
No. I don't know how it works. Because it wouldn't have been optioned.
Yeah, if it went to NBC, then it wouldn't be, no. Because if Fox turned it down and then it went to NBC, then it wouldn't be.
Oh, okay. Disney. It's not that I'm suggesting they put it on Disney Plus, because fuck that.
Even if it was owned by Fox, who are now owned by Disney, I think because it never got past the pilot stage, I think they're past the time where they would retain the rights to it.
Fair enough.
The rights are probably still kicking around all over the place. Mm. Well, they've talked about a potential new USA version recently, didn't they?
Yeah. Did they?
I'd actually quite like to do a special on what you'd like to do with a new USA special.
Not start it. No, I'm moving on because I can't cope. Next article is Arnold J. Rimmer, My Life, My Diaries. And as the title suggests, it is diary entries written by Rimmer in conversation with Holly. And it wasn't very funny, and there was a Gary Glitter gag.
Yeah, it went on a bit too long. There were bits of it I did like, which is the fact that each one starts with him saying tape on, because he's having to dictate it.
Yes.
It's almost the thing that people like us would notice is he points out that the cat's clothes are getting more and more extravagant, which does happen from like series 3 to 4 and onwards.
True.
He stops wearing the zoot suits and starts making more things. I did like the line about this, even though a ship the size of this has only got to be limited amounts of silver lame and crocodile skin.
I like the fact that it was set at the end of November, so that there's 23rd of November, then 24th, then it skips straight to 26th, because he slept all the way through Gazpacho Soup Day, because he wanted to avoid it.
Well spotted, Colin.
Well, he does talk about that in November, the 26th, but yeah, I did like the fact that, because I spotted that when I looked at November 24th. Oh, they've skipped it, right, and then carried on reading. I thought that was quite cool.
It's got a slightly more serious undercurrent in that he's trying to find Kachansky's disc.
Yeah.
And that Lister's hid it, which I don't think is the case in the show, is it?
It's the other way around, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. But this could be before that, but I don't think it's a case that Lister's hid it for Rimmer to steal it back. It's just a case that Rimmer nicked it. But I thought it was just a nice little thing that Lister's actually hidden the disc from Rimmer, but it doesn't really make sense in the long term of it. Why would he do it?
Yeah.
Hmm. Next up is All the World is a Conceptual Map, and it's more of the stuff with the creator of Better Than Life,
Professor Nita Lewis.
Yeah, it's all a little bit, I put that it's all a little bit Evil Holodeck.
Mm. I like the bit that there's a bit in there where he's this one's a bit more philosophical. I can't speak.
Philosophical.
That's the word. Philosophical. yeah. So it's a bit more like about philosophy and stuff, because it's got the bit where he's talking about that thought experiment where a scientist recreates himself down to his tiniest thought, and then if the original scientist dies but the other one is still living, and it's a bit like that bit that Vision was talking about in WandaVision.
True.
That bit to me that did tie in a bit to me with the Evil Holodeck idea of, because the whole interview is taking place in Better Than Life, isn't it? The reporters in Better Than Life.
Yeah,
and this person, I just felt like almost like an evil villain hinting that he was a clone and that the real Doctor is dead.
Yeah.
For me, that's kind of what I took of it, that Better Than Life has become sentient, almost.
It was really sinister, and I think I'd have liked some more, but spoilers, we don't.
No, I mean, the books go into it in a lot more detail, and in the books, Better Than Life is extremely sinister.
Yeah,
I mean, this almost feels like it's a bit of a like prequel to the book.
Yeah,
but it's very fourth dimensionally in that Red Dwarf magazine is a thing, and it's unless Red Dwarf magazine in this timeline is like the equivalent of Virgin Airways magazine that you get handed when you get on the plane.
It's a weird combination of in-universe stuff and out-of-universe stuff. It's like non-diegetic and actual diegetic sound, if that's the word.
It's definitely strange, and it almost feels out of place. It almost feels like if they released it now, it would work as like a prequel-y thing to like an upcoming series.
Yeah.
In the same way that Doctor Who would do stuff like that. They'd put like a little short online with maybe not the main characters in, but somebody else. I think it was the first series they put like a 2-minute short online before
the episode. And they were really cool.
Yeah.
Like the stuff that Cloverfield was doing with, where it got the different little companies and stuff, websites turning up all over the place before the film came out, and nobody knew what the film was even going to be about.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of world-building-y type stuff is really cool.
Well, I think so.
It just seems to be like this feels like one of those, but it doesn't go anywhere.
Yeah.
Next up is the episode guide, and randomly it's for Series 3 rather than Series 1. And that gives you synopsises, cast notes, and some quotes.
I don't think it's that random, though, because didn't they say that the third series was just about to come out on VHS?
Yes.
Yeah, but maybe.
They are in a completely fucking random order for the ones following in later episodes, and they do basically hang a lampshade on that and say, which one will it be next? We don't even know. And stuff like that. I do think the episode guide is a massive missed opportunity. Because it could have been, like, do you remember the big, thick episode guides that you used to get for, like, The X-Files and Buffy the Vampire Slayer, where it went into loads of cool behind-the-scenes stuff, way more than the cast notes that you get in these. You know, it'll give you bits of information that you wouldn't find anywhere else. Now, obviously, they couldn't necessarily get that information. But actually, they're pretty well connected with the fact that they've been able to get on-set reports in the previous issue, and they've got, you know, they're interviewing an actual cast member in each one.
I mean, it could be that they saved that for, because I can't remember now if they did an episode, but for the companion guide.
Yeah.
So maybe.
Saving all the good stuff for that.
Yeah.
It just felt that it wasn't very detailed. And anybody who's as much of a fan as they buy this magazine would know everything in that article, not dissimilar to the An Introduction to Red Dwarf.
The Beginner's Guide, yeah. It seems to me like these are the press releases that they'd send out to the Radio Times and stuff like that. And they've near enough word for word just copied them.
Bit naff, innit?
Yeah.
Yeah. Next up is the Red Dwarf fun page, which is still funny as fuck. And this one features Lister's Riddle Me Re and Rimmer's Intellectual Poser.
And also, we were talking in the previous episode about how it was trying to walk the line between being for kids and not. And it didn't have the let's get out there and twat it shirt in the t-shirts bit. Lister's Riddle Me Re. My first is in Smegger because I'm such a git. My second's in Tidy and Lickety-Split. My third is in Woman that I'll never get. My fourth is in Exams, I failed the whole set. My fifth is in Ace, but also in Hole. My sixth is in Officer, my impossible goal. My hole is a smeghead, a goit and a prat. I'm dead, but I'm still a complete total twit.
Yeah.
I think they may have been told to change a word in that.
Maybe.
They originally put in that.
Yeah, I loved it. I don't care. I just find that kind of humour absolutely hilarious because I'm a big kid.
Yeah. it's great. I love it. And Rimmer's Intellectual Poser, where it's, you know, five pictures of telegraph poles. Can you tell which one is different from the others?
And the answer of it, Rimmer can't tell either.
Yeah.
So, the final thing is, next issue we can expect more comic strip, another episode guide, an interview with Hattie Heyridge, the cat's fashion tips, some real reader's letters, and a free fucking badge!
Which said Smeghead, because I had it for years on my coat.
Amazing.
Although not on my school coat, I wasn't allowed it on my school coat.
Funny that. So, what do we think of issue 2? I thought it was still pretty good, but I actually think issue 1 was better.
Yes.
I'd agree with that. I think visually, it's a big step up.
True.
It's just little things like in the Robert Llewellyn interview, you've got some text behind the text, if you get what I mean, and there's pictures in it. Part of me wonders if the people who were doing the layout are kind of learning as they're going along.
Yeah.
The software. Of whatever they're using. Also, it kind of dawned on me that these comics were probably hand-drawn and not on a computer.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Which the fact that they're as clear as they are, I mean, even though we're watching it, we're looking at like an archive PDF of them, but it's still incredibly clear. And really, really, I just think this issue, from a style standpoint, is a massive step up. Even down to the fact it says something that's inside the issue on the front this time.
True. It's almost like the first issue was like a rough around the edges pilot.
Yes, yeah, definitely.
But they had to make sure that they hooked people in, so put the really good stuff in there.
True. So, favourite and least favourite. We'll go with Carl first.
My favourite bit is, again, I'm a sucker for a good interview, so it's the Robert Llewellyn interview.
Yeah, it's good.
Just because, again, he, as I mentioned it with Chris Barry on yesterday's episode, about how it's interesting the other stuff he's done kind of gets overlooked. Robert Llewellyn, there's probably a lot of stuff like you never realised he did, like he did like Edinburgh for years, and he was mostly a stage actor.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was in a sort of comedy troupe and all that kind of thing. And I think I only knew any of the stuff he did before Red Dwarf when I read his book.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating to see how much he's done and how much he does now as well. He's still out there doing lots and lots of bits and bobs, especially online. And so I always find that quite interesting, and sort of what they're doing outside of this. Like, for, I mean, I'm sure we'll get to one where Craig Charles is being interviewed and he starts talking about his poetry. And he's kind of not mentioned. He doesn't get remembered for that a lot, but he did some really good stuff if you look for it online.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So definitely the interviews for me, definitely.
What about Lee's favourite?
Probably the review of Series 3. It's, again, it felt superfluous to what's going on. Maybe if, with the videos coming out at the time, it might have worked in that case. But I kind of feel like some of the descriptions give away some jokes.
Yeah.
If you've not seen them, like talking about, I think it's in Maroon, they go into Alexander the Great's chief eunuch and Lister losing his virginity on a golf course.
It's
like, I've not seen the episode. That's spoilt now.
Yeah.
True.
And if it's only coming out on video at the time, then you're like, oh, so it doesn't, you know, it's going to, you're going to disconnect from it.
Were spoilers as much a thing back then? Because I know 10 years before that, or slightly more than that, spoilers weren't a thing, because David Prowse was going around the sort of interview circuit for The Empire Strikes Back going, and it turns out that Darth Vader's Luke's father.
Right, fair enough.
Where it all sprung from, though, that.
So, you know, I don't know if people thought of spoilers as much back then. Obviously, people can let me know if I'm completely wrong. It's entirely possible.
I mean, we are talking about stuff that has been on telly already.
Yeah,
true.
It's probably not spoiling it, but if they're trying to get new fans in, like we talked about before, revealing what happened, essentially, it's almost like 60% of what happens in the episode is revealed without the ending being revealed.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't be annoyed if I was just about to sit down, because I think, like a lot of us, we ended up watching series 1, 2, and 3 later because they weren't available to us.
Yeah.
Yeah,
if I'd read this first, I'd have probably still been a little bit annoyed because I kind of would know some of the bits in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I wouldn't mind if it was just a description, but the fact it's telling jokes as well, that I don't like that bit at all.
No. So, Colin, what about you? Favourite and least favourite?
My absolute favourite bit in this one is Lister's cookery ideas. It's fucking brilliant and I love it. It's completely stupid and ridiculous, just like me, so it's fine. Least favourite, again, is the episode guide. It was such a missed opportunity.
And for me, it's 3 for 3 again on our least favourite, because the episode guide was indeed cack. And just because I can, I have a dual winner in the favourite, because the fun page was still brilliant.
Yeah.
And Lister's cookery, man. Lister's fucking cookery.
Yeah.
I did think with the posters that come in this, that the picture of Crichton and Camille, Robert Llewellyn has probably got framed in his house. It's a nice picture of the pair of them.
It's lovely.
Where Camille's hand is, though, it kind of looks like Crichton's pregnant. She's putting her hand on, feeling the baby kick.
Wow. Wow. That's an idea for a future episode.
Well, they sort of did it with a different character, didn't they?
Well, yeah, but he wasn't a robot.
True, true.
Mm. I mean, something that would have been interesting as well is in the Rimmer's Diaries thing, because there's a splash page before it starts of it's just a giant picture of Rimmer. If they'd used the book cover from Better Than Life, the one that he signs,
yeah,
that would have been interesting.
Yeah, that would have been good,
Admiral Rimmer, sir.
Right, I don't think we need to do big, long, where we can find us. Should we just do our own personal Twitter handles for this one?
Yeah, go on then.
Right, Colin, what's your Twitter handle?
It's at MogwaiFearSatan.
And Carl?
It's Mr. Carl.
And I'm at MarkAdamsHC. We all do loads of podcasts, and we'll probably mention that throughout the week. So, that's it for the second day of our seven-day exodus into this magazine. So we'll see you tomorrow. And until then,
right, who's up for a round of peach surprise?
Me.
Shipwrecked and Comatose, a Red Dwarf podcast, was created and produced by Mark Adams and Kurt North. You can find us on Twitter at Red Dwarf Pod, and we are part of the We Made This Podcast Network, which can be found online at wemadethispod.com or on Twitter at We Made This Pod.
Hello, everyone. This is Tony, Network Chief of We Made This. As you know, our podcast network brings together a brilliant assortment of talent who talk about all kinds of pop culture content, such as the episode you've just listened to. We're not going anywhere, but we'd love to keep the lights on for even longer if you're able to support our network on Patreon. For just £2 a month, you get your name in lights and the satisfaction of knowing you're helping us produce more great audio. And for £3 a month, you'll get your name in lights, but you'll also get access to an exclusive bi-monthly podcast from the We Made This talent pool on podcasting, pop culture, and, well, you tell us. We'll take your suggestions. For less than the price of a coffee per month, you can help keep We Made This going. Just head to patreon.com/WeMadeThis. That's patreon.com/WeMadeThis. And get the ball rolling.
Elsewhere on We Made This. The Giddy Carousel of Pop.
There's a little bit with fan clubs, and there's you're in good company there, Paul. There's Japan, The Beat, Spandau Ballet again, and The Fall Foundation, 429B Bury New Road, Salford 7, Lancashire.
So if people had written to this, what would they have got in return? Can you remember?
Well, it's interesting you could say that, because we did write back. We basically, every now and again, Mark would give us a few letters and say, write back to them. And one of the people who got a reply and who still got the letter, Stuart Lee and Bob Stanley, I sent him a letter, apparently, so I'm led to believe later on. I replied to his letter and sent him a letter and a poster, and he's still got the poster. He's lost the letter, though. So, I mean, I don't know how much we did reply, but there was no fan club then. I think The Fall had a fan club later on. The Fall Foundation was just, write us a letter and we might send you one back. I think that's as far as it went.
Back to the decade.
However, like, just last week, Gore Verbinski announced he's going to return to animation with two films in the next 3 years that are like a similar style.
Huh.
So we'll have to see how that goes.
Why not Ringo? What's going on with Johnny Depp these days? Everything cool?
Yeah, is he okay? I mean, he's... there's nothing wrong with him, right?
Life's milestones.
So tell me your favorite story about your childhood.
As I mentioned earlier, I've always been kind of immersed in books. My mother was the president of the local library friends group. So every spring and fall, they would have a huge book sale at the local library. And so starting from when I was 8 years old, I was running up and down the basement stairs of the library, hauling books up to the main floor for the book sale. And I always loved it because they would always let me have whatever I wanted, whatever book I wanted. So, you know, by the time I'd leave, I had like 3 or 4 boxes worth of books to bring home. My room was full of bookshelves and I had a literal library in my childhood bedroom.
Is that something that you've continued as you've got older?
Oh yeah, I have thousands of books.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.
Right, who's up for a round of peach surprise?
Me.
I would totally give it a go.
If we did do a YouTube channel, that's one to try.
Oh, Shami Kebab Diablo.
Oh, there's so many recipes.
Somebody must have pitched a cookbook at some point and then someone will have to go, no, we'll kill people.
I'd buy the Red Dwarf cookbook.
I mean, I've seen weirder cookbooks out there. Maybe this is what...
Nanny Ogg, fucking Discworld cookbook, isn't there?
Yeah, there's a...
This is what Rob Grant wants.
There's a Fallout one.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
No, there's loads of recipes in it. Like squirrel bits and Deathclaw
steak. Great.
Nuka-Cola.
There's a cooking YouTube I follow called Sorted, and they did one called 50 Shades of... It basically is 50 Shades of Grey, but it's all chicken recipes.
Wow.
I've got a cookbook called Baking Black, which is all based around various metal bands and stuff like that.
Nice.
There's like Megadeth by Chocolate.